We've asked and you have spoken. The votes for the Survey Awards have been tallied and the winners have been announced. Congratulations to the local legends who have taken the crown. This has been another amazing award season, galvanizing your local communities to support the front of house team members we love so much. To see this year's winners, visit theserveys.com. And to learn more about Yelp for Restaurants and how we support restaurant owners in reaching their potential, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Now here we go.
Think through, what do you want to build here? Also, who are the best employees? What are the most successful employees? What are they doing and not doing? What are their traits and their characteristics? And then what about your worst employees? What are their traits and characteristics? And that's going to help give you kind of a yardstick about what is the culture that we actually love that we're trying to build. And then when you can reinforce that over time, that's how change happens.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. No matter where we are in our lives or our careers, we could be benefiting from coaching. The greatest athletes in the world have coaches, and for an obvious reason. Investing in our betterment improves every aspect of our lives. Today we chat with Alyssa Cohn, a famed executive coach who's worked with the best of the best. In our conversation, she shares the tactics, tools, and strategies she's used to make the best even better.
I wanted to make a difference. So what led me there was my recognition. I was at PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is a great firm. I was on the fast track to partner, 5 years to partner. And I woke up kind of 2.5 years in and I just thought, I hope I get the flu so I don't have to go to work tomorrow. And 16 hours later, I was rushed to the emergency room with the flu. So I knew that something was wrong. And I had to seek out what I really wanted to do. I just really thought, like, this is not it. So what is it? And the only thing I had in my head was, I want to make a difference, to make a difference, that the work of my hands matters. And I went to this, you know, I did a bunch of things and sort of exploratory. And I went to this conference called Body and Soul. And I met a coach. And I was like, what is that? Violins played. I want to do that. And so it was kind of, I followed her around. I took coach training. And I joined the startup world for a couple of years. I was the CFO of one startup, the head strategy of another startup. And when that all imploded, I said, great, I'm going to become a coach now. And it's been one foot in front of the other for 22 years.
Let's talk about that. So, I mean, obviously, there's just massive courage involved in deciding that just because you're good at something doesn't mean that's what you were called to do. So as you begin to make that career shift, and I mean, you were nestled in the bosom of a large company that's probably not going to go out of business. Lovely 401k, subsidized healthcare. What was the thought process that took you from that to actually making the entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, I mean, what I just thought, I mean, all those things are true, as well as if you retire as a partner from one of those firms, you have pension for life kind of thing. So it was very cushy and very safe, if you will. But I just knew that something was calling me differently. I mean, my body was speaking to me. It was clear. And it was kind of terrifying. One thing I did that other people don't do is I had always heard from the head partner in the Boston office, which is where I was, Jay Maddy. He was so kind. And he always said, if you ever, people are thinking about leaving, let me know. And if I can get you to stay, I'll probably try to get you to stay. But if I can't, I'll probably introduce you to a whole bunch of other people in our clients. So I'm the only idiot who actually said, Jay, I'm thinking about leaving. He was amazing to me. He said, I understand that maybe you're not meant for this. Maybe you actually want to do something more entrepreneurial. He sort of saw that in me. And he made a bunch of introductions for me. And that helped me get used to the idea that I was actually leaving. And I really kind of thought, I am too young at this point to just be a coach. I knew I wanted to be a coach, but I'm too young. So I was enmeshed in coach training. And that's when I found the first job at a startup. It came from out of the blue. Somebody who I'd just met who actually wanted me to get into PwC, and he offered me the job. And so I think the bridge between this large stable company and something that was startup, which at least for the moment was stable, was a very helpful bridge before I made the leap on my own. But I will tell you, in the middle of all this, I was interviewing also, I was interested in financial planning, but I was from this business school. So I had to not just do financial planning. I had to do private wealth management. So I was interviewing with Goldman. To my surprise, I got the job at Goldman doing private wealth management, and I turned it down. And then I went to join the startup. And within 2 weeks in the startup, I just thought, I have made a bad decision. This is a bad idea. So I called Goldman back and I said, I made a mistake. I want the job. And he said, no, too late. You said no. And then he did me a favor and he said, you have a superpower. When you say something, you have a lot of credibility and confidence, and I believe you. And somehow he told me that and it landed for me. And I knew that I was going to be okay because I was going to be able to generate other opportunities for myself no matter what. And oh, by the way, the startup was a fantastic opportunity. And that led me to another startup. And by then, I sort of, I think, had enough practice coaching, if you will, to decide that I was just going to try it for a period of time. But wait, the last thing I want to say, though, is that as I was contemplating just finally leaving and just going out on my own, I was in the gym, of all places, where all the important things happened to me. I was in the gym and I couldn't get on the machine because I was so scared. And I started crying in the gym. And somehow I channeled my 90-year-old self. And my 90-year-old self was looking at me and saying, what was she so upset about? She had parents who were not going to let her starve. She had some money in the bank. What was she so upset about? And that's when I realized that I had the opportunity to take a leap. And if it didn't work out, I would figure out the next thing.
That's beautiful. And honestly, kind of relieving, right? It was a very human moment. You had a very human reaction and pushed through. When you decide to become a coach, I think kind of when you just, if I could go back and do it all over again, sadly, there is no restaurateur school, right? It would be so nice if there was, that you learn how to do it. When I decided to get into coaching, I did the same thing. I got a coach that specialized in teaching coaches how to coach, because as it turns out, there's a framework through which people can learn, and there's a communication style that helps people receive information, even information they don't necessarily want to receive. You know, just how they talk about how therapists have therapists, coaches typically have coaches. Talk to me about your firsthand experience with a coach and how it informed the type of coach you are.
Yeah. My first coach, I'm putting in quotation marks, was my therapist. I always call her fondly a very bossy therapist. So I would even say from the point of view, she's not the kind of person who's going to ask questions and just see what I have to say. She's the one who told me when the startup world was kind of imploding, she's the one who said to me, you've always said you want to do something on your own. The time is now. This is the time. You can always get another job doing the same thing you've been doing. This is the moment. So that was very powerful. And honestly, all the frameworks that she used with me that we used in therapy, I have been able to use with my clients. So there's definitely a lot of resonance there for sure. But then in terms of the business of coaching, I hired my own coach and she helped me by giving me standard agreements and intro questions and a few frameworks. And specifically, she told me, now go out and get 10 no's, which I still tell other people, because getting yeses is hard. Getting no's is easy, right? You can always go out and get 10 no's. So those are the kinds of people, early coaches who helped me on my journey. And then of course, as I became, after I was sort of 3 or so years into my coaching practice, I met Dr. Marshall Goldsmith, who's the top executive coach on the planet. We were introduced by Marshall. He was always very kind to me. He mentored me. He took me under his wing. I worked shoulder to shoulder with him for over 2 years. And that was a massive education, of course.
Your brand, your practice, centers around startups. I would assume that's because there's passion around building things or working with people that have no money or people that are burning through money at a rapid rate. Or people that know less than people with more experience. What is it about startups that really gets you going?
Yeah, it's only some of those things, by the way. The answer, so I was in the startup world, as I said, that I had been an executive at two startups, and I always loved that environment. I love building things. I love working with people on a mission, and inside of a startup, the mission is clear. I love founders. Founders are always peering over your shoulder at a future only they can see. I remember one of my favorite clients I still work with now, a company here in New York. At some point, I said to him, they had like 30 people in a WeWork, and they had grown rather quickly from that very small acorn to this small seedling. And I said, oh, you've done such a great job. You've really built this great thing. And he said, Alyssa, we are just getting started. Now there are 500, 600 employees, and they're still on a tear despite the macro environment. And I love that attitude. I love the future orientation, the optimism, and I really love new things that I can't personally conceive of. I also love leadership. I also love being able to teach people, to your point, who don't have a lot of experience, the shortcuts and the tricks that they can use to help them on their journey and help them move forward faster.
Where's the low-hanging fruit? I would assume that when you go into a new company, that there's an audit, either practical or mental, that you do, boxes that you're looking to check. What gauges do you use to determine the overall health of an organization as you enter it?
Yeah. So two things to say about that. First is, if I'm working with a founder, CEO, or a leader in the startup, I do 360 feedback. And 360 feedback is the process where I talk to folks all around him or her to find out what he's great at, what he needs to get better at, and what specific suggestions they have to make him or her a better leader. And it's very insightful about this person, but also about the culture, because they talk about the culture as we do this conversation. So I'm getting a sense of what it's like to be around here. The second is the practices the leader uses. Are they having an executive team meeting? How often? What are they talking about? Do they have formalized goal processes? Do they have ways to measure what's going on? Is there a set, one or more employees who needs a little conversation? Maybe needs to get fired. He's been hanging around for a while and no one has done anything with them. All of those things are ways that I sort of have a diagnostic of seeing what's going on. Because the question I want to ask always when I enter a new environment is like, what's going on around here? What's it like to be here? What's it like to be part of this culture? And what needs to change and happen to create scale?
Are there common problems and common solutions?
Yeah, I would say there are common problems. I'm not positive for common solutions because they're all tailored to a certain person. But there's a common problem that leaders forget that they're under surveillance all the time. And that you as a leader, your suggestions are orders. Your inklings are orders. Your brainstorms are orders. Your mumblings are orders. And your orders are orders. And you forget that. I tell a story in my book that one of the CEOs I worked with, he said that at the Christmas party, it went so well, and it was just down the street at this restaurant. And he said, that was so convenient. The only way to be more convenient is if we're in the parking lot. And in August of that year, one of his employees said, do you want a tent in the parking lot? And he said, what are you talking about? And the employee said, you said you wanted the Christmas party this year in the parking lot, which he said to me, can you believe it? But of course, I can believe it because that is a common thing that happens. The corollary to that is, so if you're the leader, Josh, of 500 people and you're delegating and you want something done or you're just talking to people. People are going to say when you're not there, Josh wants or Josh says, or I talked to Josh and this is what he has in mind. And they're not using their own influence skills. They're using you and your influence skills. And that is, again, a common way of interacting, getting things done inside of companies.
And is that a positive thing or a negative thing, or is that just a thing? Because I see it in the organizations that I consult in, that I'll say, what about this? And say, oh, well, you know, the founder wants it that way. Or the founder said this, or the founder said that. And I mean, autonomy is great in theory and even sometimes in practical application. But is that a sign of corporate health or is that an ailment?
Here's the ailment. The ailment is that people can't get anything done unless they invoke the name of the founder or invoke the name of the leader. That's a problem. Now, I will say that it is true. The leader has to make a decision sometimes, as in this is how we're doing it. For example, famously at Amazon, when Jeff and his team, which mostly Jeff actually, decided that they were going to move away from PowerPoint, banning PowerPoint at meetings and doing their famous 6-page memo. And that's what they were going to do. What Jeff said was, no more PowerPoint ever. This is the structure I want you to write a memo in from now on. And then the first few meetings, people would come to the meeting with PowerPoint and he'd get, I think, spicy from what I understand. And he would say, I said no more PowerPoint. And so one thing to say is that they thought he wasn't talking to them. And the second thing to say was he's serious. Jeff said no more PowerPoint. Jeff said 6-page memo. So you need sometimes that kind of hammer authority, the moral authority of the leader and the founder when you have a sweeping decision. However, if you have all the people in your company only doing stuff that Jeff wants or Jeff doesn't want because Jeff said or Jeff didn't say, you are not teaching people to interact in a complex environment. You, the founder, and you, the leader, have no idea what's going on really inside of the organization. So you making the decisions at that level is actually counterproductive. And that's where politics seeps into the company because everyone's vying for the authority of what Jeff said or didn't say. So that's kind of the problem with it. But I do want to say that I think some people are very naive when they say, oh, the leader should let everybody make the decisions, or, oh, the founder shouldn't decide, he should delegate. Well, you really have to make sure that's where it's so important to have the right people who are going to use good judgment, make good decisions, and that are going to be capable of receiving the items that you delegate to them.
Yeah, I think it's also, and you touch on this in the book, so many of us are focused on the evolution of our business, not realizing that that's going to be entirely dependent on our evolution as a leader. It's that idea that, you know, what got you here won't get you there. When you start a company and you work with a ton of startups, it's scrappy, it's in the garage, you're in a WeWork, and everybody's rooting for you because you're the underdog. But at some point, you're not the underdog anymore. At some point, you went from fighting the man to becoming the man. And you have to rally your troops in a different way. There's a level of professionalism that must exist in order for you to be able to get the company to the next level. What hurdles have you seen around professionalizing what felt like at some point a mom and pop?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even call it a mom and pop. I mean, to your point, scrappy garage, it's like a Hewlett Packard situation, right?
Yeah.
But then at some point, when you have a number of employees, they're maybe here for the mission, but they're also here for the 401k. They're also here for the career advancement. They're also here for the career safety. You've got to deliver for these people in a predictable way. The other thing to say is that as you build your company and you get from 500 people to 5,000 people to 50,000 people over time, you just need to have structures and systems and processes in place. And the pirates who were in the early days of the startup with you are not the kind of people who want to do those kinds of processes. In fact, it's the rare founder who himself wants to do those kinds of processes, but that's what you need to have predictable operational excellence. So it's about figuring out where are the points where you have to implement more process in order to make sure that you have the professionalism you're talking about.
Time and time again, I see restaurateurs opening new concepts and repeating old mistakes. The most powerful tool we have is the experience of experts we can trust. Mike Benson and the team from Southern California Restaurant Design Group have built literally hundreds of restaurants and have worked with the best in the biz. Exclusively for Full Comp listeners, Mike and his team have crafted the essential checklist to opening a restaurant. This free guide explains in detail the steps we should take to complete our next project on time and on budget. Go to SoCalRestaurantDesign.com/FullComp to download this powerful free resource today. You mentioned it at the top of the conversation, but the way that we were introduced was through Marshall. And in a moment in my life when things weren't going particularly well, and I was referred to you because I needed help, I needed guidance, I needed clarity. And I can remember when I was training to become a coach, my coach's name was Taki Moore. And Taki always talks about true, not new. That like most coaches just need to talk about what is true and remind people what is true, that new isn't necessarily better. And then I look at our session, right? And I came to you in a way that so many people do. I was panicked. I was in the midst of overwhelm. I could not see clearly, right? When I got off the call, I was crystal clear. My situation hadn't changed, but my outlook had. And I want you to talk about the tactics, the tools, the strategies that you use with your clients to achieve that level of clarity in moments where, candidly, it is reasonable to panic.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm glad that that was helpful for you. And that's reminding me of a discussion I had today with a client, literally today, who told me, I recognize that I'm kind of running out of money. Not kind of, I'm running out of money and I should have started fundraising much earlier. And now I don't know what to do. So we had to deal with it on two levels. First is that he was feeling bad about it. I made a screw up. I can't believe I did this. What's wrong with me? A real founder wouldn't have done this, right? So like sort of imposter syndrome, which is very common with many founders, with really many successful people. So dealing with that first, the inner life, that's why my book From Startup to Grown Up is divided into three sections: managing you, managing them, and managing the business. We start with you. Because we can deal with you got to raise money, but we first have to start with you and get yourself right. So we worked together to really identify specifically what he was saying to himself and how that was showing up. And then I like true, not new. What's actually true? What's actually true is that he left a stable, secure job to become an entrepreneur. Why? Because he thought he could make an impact, because he had this different idea of the way things should be going, because he wanted to run his own thing, because he was exhilarated by the process. So I had to remind him of all that, of why he became an entrepreneur. Then I had to help him understand what was true, which is it is normal to make mistakes. It is expected to make mistakes. And what I know is that he wants to make the pretty little mistakes, the cute mistakes, the mistakes that are going to look so good in his memoir. No, you get those mistakes, but those are not the important mistakes. The important mistakes are when you really screw up. And that's how you have to now figure out how to either, as I told him, find a way or make a way, because that's what entrepreneurs do. Now, the second thing is, how do you raise money? Well, simple, but not easy. There is a well-trod process and path to raise money. You have to enact that with urgency as if your life depended on it, because it does. And then, of course, I reminded him of all the founder stories that are out there, including Brian Chesky of Airbnb, including many others who got rejected, who were running out of money, who were at their last legs, and they were able to pull it out, because that's what a founder does. So I think that what he told me today is he emerged from our discussion both clear-eyed but also energized. And that right. is always my goal.
I love that. One of the things that came out of our initial conversation, because you said, just like you just said now, tell me what's going on. And then I started with the story. Right? The story of what's going wrong in my life. And you stopped me a minute and a half into it and you said, stop. That's not what I want to hear. I just want to hear about the situation. I don't want to hear your story about the situation. I just want to hear the situation. And I think it's important to bring up and to reiterate here, because so much of what was blocking me was the story around my devastation and how upset I was and how could I be in this situation. All of the feelings and all of the stories, which had nothing to do with the actual situation, just had to do with my viewpoint of the situation, they were preventing me from seeing what was really true and really clear out there. Talk to me about hard conversations, because I think that for the leaders listening, they could probably get a lot of value from your tactics and your techniques as it relates to having tough conversations in a way that benefits both you and the person that needs to receive the information.
Yeah. So my philosophy is simple. The quality of your life and the quality of your business is in direct proportion to the number of difficult conversations that you are willing to have. So you have to sort of really think about that. And you could even think right now, what conversations am I putting off that I'm uncomfortable having, that I don't feel comfortable addressing, that I'm sort of feeling awkward about? Those are the ones where all the gold is stored. I promise you that. Because ultimately, if you are feeling constrained, if you are feeling resentful, if you're feeling there's something between us in some way, if you don't address it, it is definitely going to fester. It is going to grow and is going to really infuse your entire relationship with some bad energy. And at its worst, it's certainly going to prevent things from moving forward. There was one founder I worked with. He had a product manager, the head of product, who was not getting the job done. A very wonderful person. They were friends. He should have gotten the job done. He should have been capable. He wasn't capable for whatever reason. And he put off the conversation he needed to have with him for 2 years. In that 2 year period, an unintended toxic culture grew up around him. People worked around this person. People gossiped about this person. The progress on this important milestones initiatives was not made because this founder was unwilling to have the difficult conversation and ultimately take difficult action with this person. So I guess I would say a few things. First is you can have difficult conversations which are direct and diplomatic. I would never say you have to be a jerk to somebody. You should not be a jerk to someone. You always have to recognize there's a human being over there. There's a human being over there who's trying to do a good job. And the fact they're not doing a good job is a source of frustration to them, first and foremost, as well as their team, as well as you. So think about that you can have difficult conversations which are direct and diplomatic. Number two, think through the goal of the discussion, because very often people just unload. I'm so frustrated. And here is another thing I need to share and tell you this and that and the other. Not helpful, maybe human, but not helpful. You've got to think about what am I trying to do to get this person to change, to get this person to understand, to get invoke a reaction or an action from this person. That's the goal. And then the third thing is really outline the discussion, practice the discussion with somebody else, with the mirror. In my book, From Startup to Grown Up, I actually have 14 scripts that will help you kind of outline for yourself difficult conversations, and you can use them as the basis for difficult conversations for common issues that will come up for you as a leader. And when you practice them, you get your mouth around the words, and that can be very helpful when you go deliver it.
Well, and also, I think you do an excellent job of advocating to prevent bad issues before they happen, especially as it relates to co-founders. The type of communication that you advocate, the type of strategies that you choose to employ, I would assume that they avoid more problems than they create. I think a great example of that is, talk to me about assessing the skill gap.
Well, first of all, I want to talk about the co-founder prenup that I have with co-founders, right? The idea that the two of you should have conversations about what your values are, what you're looking for, what you're hoping success looks like, how you dealt with conflict when you were growing up. All those kinds of things are very helpful conversations for you to have before you decide to co-found, because otherwise there you are 5 years in. And this did happen with two co-founders I work with. 5 years in, you have one co-founder who wishes we were still small and he knew everybody else's name. And you have another co-founder who's trying to build a big business. 5 years in is not the time to realize you do not have the same vision for what you're trying to build. Now, when I think about a skills gap inside of a co-founder relationship, the truth is that if you're the co-founders, both of you, it's like your entry-level position is leader. You're missing a lot of skills. And you have to take a proactive stance that you're going to rapidly gain skills that you need to do your job. You don't need to have the same skills. In fact, you should have complementary skills. But you need to both learn the tools of leadership and management. You both need to learn how to delegate. You both need to learn domain expertise on these, the areas that you're leading and the business as a whole. And I think what sometimes happens is one co-founder is advancing rapidly and one co-founder is getting stuck. And then the question is, how do they have that difficult conversation about making sure that the other co-founder who's not maybe keeping up is either in the right role or understands that she has to rapidly gain skills in order to keep up with the growth of the company. That is very difficult, but if you don't do it, what you're doing now is you're working around your own co-founder and people are working around her or him as well. And not only that, but then people feel like at times, it's like we have two different companies. These are all normal things that happen. Does not make them good. If they're happening in your company, they are not good and you should put a stop to them.
You mentioned culture earlier. You also mentioned creating a toxic workplace. My industry is known the world round for toxicity in the workplace. And Lord knows many, many, many of us are working to change that. But change is hard and change requires just a massive effort by a massive number of people, especially if you're trying to change something foundationally across an entire industry. What are your best practices as it relates to fostering a positive culture?
Positive culture is really about identifying what you actually want inside of this company. So two co-founders I work with spent their first year in business talking through, what does a great workplace look like? Who are the kind of people that I want to work with? And what do we want to foster around here culturally? And so when you have that in mind as like the North Star, number one, you can hire the people who fit into that code. Number two, you can constantly reinforce that, pointing out behaviors for other people so that they can see what great looks like. And then number three, you can make sure that you hold people accountable to the standards that you've all agreed to. So setting it up in advance like that is very helpful. If you're talking about change, which does happen because probably you forgot to set it up, it's the same process. Think through, what do you want to build here? Also, who are the best employees? What are the most successful employees? What are they doing and not doing? What are their traits and their characteristics? And then what about your worst employees? What are their traits and characteristics? And that's going to help give you kind of a yardstick about what is the culture that we actually love that we're trying to build. And then when you can reinforce that over time, that's how change happens.
How many of your founders are actually struggling with clearly defining where they want to go?
You mean in terms of the business?
I mean, just in general, I think that for so many of us, you know, a murky vision will get you started. It'll probably even get you pretty far down the road. But at some point, there has to be this clarity of vision. This is where we're going. This is exactly how we're going to get there. In my experience, the best founders possess it, and there are a few of them that do to that degree.
Yeah, where I've seen struggle is the how. So a lot of the founders I work with have an amazing vision and really understand it and are able to sell it to others, including investors and including their employees, which is why they joined. They are not always the best at breaking it down into actionable steps, which is why you have to hire other people to help operationalize the vision to help you get where you're going.
Are there similar characteristics across all of your founders that do exceptionally well?
Each person is their own person. That's what's amazing. There's one founder I work with who's, I'm going to say, fairly unemotional and yet very accessible. So people feel like they have a personal relationship with him. And that really comes in handy. Another founder I work with is very gregarious. I guess I would say, actually, to your point about vision, big picture on the vision and can't always communicate it. And so has learned how to take a step back and really make sure that he's communicating the pieces that are important, not just the thing itself. I guess I would say all the founders I work with have a very different style, but I think what is similar to them is persistence, and they will never stop and they will always find a way. And I've seen companies in particular, which have 9 lives, just keep coming back from the dead in order to win. And that's very inspiring.
You've referenced your book several times. I read it myself. It's absolutely fabulous. For those that aren't familiar with the book, what's the intention? You hope that people walk away from reading the book with what?
Well, I wrote my book From Startup to Grown Up because I would enter a situation and I would say something like, how often do you meet with your leadership team? And they would say to me, what's a leadership team? And I was like, I wish I had a book that I could hand them to prevent unforced errors. And I couldn't find that kind of book, so I wrote it myself. And what I'm hoping it does is it helps founders along their personal growth journey to grow into leaders. But the truth is, it's actually for all leaders as they grow into leaders, because everybody needs to be thinking about how they are growing personally along the axes of managing yourself, managing the team, and managing the business overall.
What should we steal from you? We've had a wonderful conversation. You have so many tactics, tools, and strategies. Somebody walking away that wants to make their lives, wants to make their businesses better today. What's some actionable advice? What are some tools that they should steal from you to get it done?
Well, the first tool you can steal from me is on my website. And if you go to my website, alyssacohn.com/scripts, you will see 5 scripts that will help you have difficult conversations and 1 to make your life better. And you can download those scripts for free and take them and use them, as well as the scripts in the back of my book. I think the other advice I would have is, you really have to have an intentionality and a goal for your life and your business, a set of goals, an intention and a purpose. And if you don't have that, then you're just kind of waving around. So sitting down and really clarifying for yourself, where are you going? What I say about coaching is it's about where are you? Where are you going? And how will you get there? And you could do a writing exercise about that. A writing exercise I give my clients that you should all do is called My Best Possible Life 5 Years in the Future. So you write down My Best Possible Life 5 Years in the Future. And you write down the date 5 Years in the Future. And then you write down My Age 5 Years in the Future. And then you just start writing. Whatever comes up for you, what makes up your best possible life? And it could be obviously in part your career. And also it will be your family situation, where you're living. Do that exercise every day for 2 weeks and you'll start to really see what is resonating inside of you, what is really driving you. So that's one activity. A second activity is for everyone to do a check-in with yourself 2-3 times a day, super quick check-in. What's draining me today? What's energizing me today? What do I know that I'm putting off and I need to get done? And questions like that, again, in my book, will help you reset yourself every day, because the way you manage your energy is the way you really make progress in the world. And I think that's a very important thing that people overlook.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Alyssa Cohn. You can pick up her book, From Startup to Grown Up, Grow Your Leadership to Grow Your Business, wherever books are sold. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Koppel. You've been listening to Full Comp.